We're now going to take a look at the crime of humanism and humanists favored or allowed by apostate antipopes. First of all, I want to define what humanism is. Humanism is the glorification of philosophy, or the glorification of mythology, or the glorification of immorality. And scholasticism, therefore, is humanism because it is a glorification of philosophy. Scholasticism glorifies philosophy either by using the philosophical method or glorifying pagan philosophers and their pagan philosophies. The glorification of mythology involves the glorification of the false gods and false religions of mythology. Now, these three things, the glorification of philosophy, mythology, and immorality, consists of what the basic crimes of the humanists. Now, some of the authors do not consider scholasticism humanism. They don't look at it as humanism, but it is humanism. And so they don't incorporate when they're talking about humanists, they won't say that Aquinas is a humanist or a Lombard is a humanist. The notorious heretics, Peter Lombard and Thomas Aquinas, they are both humanists. They are both notorious heretics because they're scholastics, which glorifies philosophy. So you're not going to get that in a lot of these books. So they're not going to condemn those guys as humanists, but they are. What they're talking about here mostly are humanists, are those who are glorifying the mythology and immorality. Now, to be a humanist, you only have to be doing one of these things. If you're glorifying philosophy, you're a humanist. If you're glorifying mythology, you're a humanist. If you're glorifying immorality, you're a humanist. And some humanists glorify all three, some only one of the three, and some two of the three. But each category is humanism. And so humanism really starts with scholasticism, a glorification of philosophy in the 11th century, and progress forward. But in this chapter, you're going to read about the apostate antipopes and also apostate anti-cardinals and clerics and a lot of other people favored or at least allowed the humanist and humanism. These guys were employed by the apostate antipopes at their papal court. And we're going to read about that. And we're going to start out with... We're going to go from all the apostate antipopes from Benedict the 12th and 13. He reigned from 1335 to 1342 to Gregory the 11th, who reigned from 1371 to 1388. All employed humanists at their papal court, and again, they're talking about the humanists that glorified the false gods and false religions and mythology and glorified immorality. And some they'll include glorify some of the pagan philosophers. But they don't include scholasticism, which they did. Then we go back to the 11th century, and any so-called pope that glorifies or favors scholasticism is also a humanist and a formal heretic and apostate. But now we're going to read from the History of Popes by the notorious heretic Ludwig Pasteur. And this is from Volume 1, Introduction, page 6. Boccaccio went three times as ambassador from the Florentines to the papal court and was well received there at the papal court. All the popes from Benedict the 12th to Gregory the 11th showed Petrarch the greatest favor, and Clement the 6th delivered the great poet from pecuniary embarrassments and procured for him the independence needed for his intellectual labors. Now we're going to read who Boccaccio was and Petrarch, so you guys get an idea of what kind of monsters these guys were. Okay, so let's see who this Boccaccio character is. The fact that he's a humanist already tells you he's a notorious heretic and idolater. And if he glorifies immorality, which this guy did do, then he's also a formal heretic for glorifying immorality, which I didn't mention in the beginning. When you glorify immorality, you're a formal heretic. It's one thing to commit a sin of immorality. It's another thing to glorify it. For instance, a man who commits adultery has committed a mortal sin against morals. And as long as he knows that's a sin, all he's guilty of is a mortal sin of immorality. But if he came out and told you that adultery is not a mortal sin, then he's a former heretic. So when I talk about glorifying immorality, which is what the humanists did, a lot of the humanists did, that's formal heresy. Because they're actually telling you that immorality is not a sin. That's what a lot of these guys did. So now we're going to read about Boccaccio. Boccaccio's writings breathe an atmosphere of heathen corruption. The way in which this great master of style and delineation of character sets as not all Christian notions of honor and decency is simply appalling. His idol Ameto reeks with the profligacy of the ancient world and preaches pretty plainly the gospel of free love, and his satire Corbaccio or The Labyrinth of Love, displays the most revolting cynicism. A critic of no severe stamp declares that even the modern naturalist writers can hardly outbid the defilement of this lampoon. And the most celebrated of all Boccaccio's works, Decameron, is a presentation of purely heathen principles in the unrestrained gratification of the passions. A modern literary historian says that the provocative, sensuous style of the stories may find its explanation without the possibility of excuse in the prevalent immorality of the times and the unchaining of evil passions. And this guy was at the papal court and favored by these popes. We have, here's the humanist Francesco Petrarch, who was born in 1304 and died in 1374. From History of Popes, again, Volume 4, Introduction, Section 2, page 99. Petrarch did not escape the leaven of his age or the influence of the dangerous elements of antiquity. He often succumbed to the sensual passions so faithfully depicted in his work on Contempt of the World. His inordinate love of preferment is another blot upon his stormy life, and we discover in him not a few traits at variance with his devout Christian intuitions. He calls it devout. You cannot be a devout Christian and idolize heathens and immorality and be devout. See, this is Pastor again. Now, usually I try to delete these things when I'm making that. I would have deleted that. But that's just so you guys know what a heretic pastor is. How could you be a devout Christian if you glorify idols and you glorify immorality? But this is the way he speaks. It is sad to see a man so eminent in intellectual gifts as Petrarch yearning after crowns of laurels, royal favors, and popular ovations, and pursuing the phantom of glory in the courts of profligate princes. Undoubtedly, this ardent passion for renown, to which the Christian conscience of the poet opposed such an inefficacious resistance, must be considered as a taint of heathenism. And the old classical authors, especially in Cicero, this ideal of human fame was so vividly presented to the mind of Petrarch that at times it entirely eclipsed the Christian ideal. So here he's saying at times he's not even Christian, but then he calls him a devout Christian. How could that be? That quote was actually from Volume 1, Introduction, pages 3 to 4. This next quote is from History of Popes, Volume 4, Introduction, Section 2, page 99. Even in Petrarch, we find an overweening vanity, which is distinctly pagan, and notions of a sort of Elysium in the next world for great men, borrowed from Cicero and Plato's Phaedon. In him, however, and in all the Christian humanists, we recognize a conflict between the two antagonistic principles of heathen self-glorification and Christian humility. And this is the guy that was serving at papal courts, at the papal courts. As the saying goes in Ecclesiastes 27:10, birds of a feather flock together. And Amos 3:3, shall two walk together except they be agreed? So therefore, these apostate antipopes were humanists themselves. Even if they didn't particularly agree with everything, by them not condemning their works, by them not denouncing them, and by them not punishing them, they're humanists. And most of these apostate folks were humanists. They liked this stuff. Others tolerated and allowed it. Equally, they're all equally guilty. So now you learn who this Giovanni Boccaccio was, and also Francesco Petrarch. Now we go on from History of Popes, and this is a footnote from Volume 1, Introduction, page 54. During the Avignon period, we meet with but few Tuscan humanists in papal service. The first of these is Petrarch's friend, Zanobi d'Estrada, whom Pope Innocent VI appointed proto-notary and secretary of briefs about the end of 1358 or beginning of 1359. Urban V summoned Francesco Bruno, another friend of Petrarch's, to Avignon about the year 1365. He was companion in the office of Coluccio Salutato, afterwards distinguished as Chancellor of Florence. And then we read another footnote. It says, regarding the appointment of the first humanist in the papal court by Innocent VI. Innocent VI, they say, was the one who was attributed for the first one who appointed a humanist at the papal court. Now, I say, as I said before, there were humanists at the papal court even before that who supported scholasticism, but they don't consider that humanism. Now, we're reading also from the History of Popes, Maffeo Vaggio must not be passed over. He was born in 1407, died in 1458. We must mention his widely read book on education as much as it represents an endeavor to combine the wisdom of the classics with the Bible and the teaching of the church. He strongly recommends the work of Virgil, Sallust, and Quintilian as means of culture, but objects to the elegiacs on account of their indecency and would have the comic authors reserved for the perusal of grown-up men. So he says only men, only adults can read this stuff, but not the kids. So it's like sort of when you go into these pornography shops, adult bookstores, they have the bad stuff in the back, and only adults can go in here, but not kids. So it's not a sin for it. When I become an adult, I can look at pornography, I can be immoral, I can break God's moral commandments and not sin. That sounds like one of those Jewish things where they make a law to break a law. They're trying to make laws where the rabbis say that they can break the Ten Commandments with Gentiles because they're not humans. The Ten Commandments only apply to them because they believe only Jews are humans. So that's how they make up a law. This is similar to that kind of a thing. So adults, it's okay for adults, but not. This is what he's saying over here. Now, in the time of Eugenius IV, Vagio came to Rome. He's the one who put the doors up, remember? The big Florentine Medici friend, Eugenius IV. Vagio came to Rome where he filled the offices of datary, abbreviator, and canon of St. Peter's, and finally became an Augustinian canon. Those members of the church who promoted the heathen view acted wrongly. Again, they're wrongly. That's putting it lightly. That's one of those light wrongly. They acted idolatrously and formally heretical for glorifying it in morality. Wrongly. That's about the strongest you hear pastors say about these guys. Well, that was wrong. Or that wasn't nice. Or it was just scandalous. Or you shouldn't have done it. Instead of what it is, which is idolatry and formal heresy for glorifying immorality and also being guilty of mortal sins of immorality. None of it. So it acted wrongly, and were, if we look at their conduct with the view of interest as a church, blameworthy. No kidding, they were blameworthy. A guy that idolized Jupiter and Apollo and immorality I think they were blameworthy. Yeah, he's got to think about this thing. Blameworthy, of course they are. Automatically, the sins against that they're committing here too is against the natural law. So this is this notorious heretic pastor, you know, he always lightens the crime a little, lessens it. Now, the church gave liberal encouragement to humanist studies. She accorded the greatest possible liberty to the adherents of the Renaissance. The friendly relations which existed between the popes and the two founders of the Renaissance literature, Petrarch and Boccaccio, have already been mentioned. No less than 5 times was Petrarch invited to fill the office of apostolic secretary. But the poet could not make up his mind to undertake the charge, fearing that it would compel him to give up literature, his special vocation. But he gladly employed himself at the desire of the learned Pope Clement VI in a collection of early manuscripts of Cicero's works for the papal library. When the tidings of the death of Petrarch, whom he had once invited to Avignon by an autograph letter, reached Pope Gregory XI, he commissioned Guillaume de Nolet, Cardinal Vicar of the Church in Italy, to make diligent inquiries after his writings and to have copies made for him. Gregory XI, whom a modern writer has justly characterized as the best of the Avignon popes, showed a notable interest in the half-forgotten heritage from the ancient world, the classics, the pagan classics. When he heard that a copy of Pompeius Trogus had been discovered at Vercelli, he at once sent a letter to the bishop of that city, desiring him immediately to look after this book and to have it conveyed to the papal court by a trusty messenger. You would think he found some gospel parchment or something of the Word of God. A few days later, or of the church fathers or something, a few days later, the same pope charged the canon of Paris to make researches in the Sorbonne Library regarding several works of Cicero's, to have them transcribed as soon as possible by competent persons and to send the copies to him at Avignon. It might at first sight have seemed likely that the storms which burst over the papacy after the death of Gregory XI would have deterred the popes from showing favor to the Renaissance. He's saying you think they would have been scared and looked upon these as punishments, which was now asserting its power in the realm of literature. And yet it was actually at the very period that a great number of humanists found admission to the Roman court. They got even worse. After God was trying to punish them and warn them, instead of amending away, they even brought more guys into the Roman court, humanists. A closer study of this time in connection with which the previous years of the residence of the popes at Avignon must be considered, will bring to light the causes of the gradual and in some respects hazardous influx of humanism into the papal court. A review of the history of the popes from the beginning of the exile to Avignon until the end of the Great Schism seems all the more necessary, as without an intimate acquaintance with this period of peril to the papacy, the latter course of events cannot be understood. In the progress of the following work, we shall show that the Renaissance gradually took root in Rome under Martin V and Eugenius IV. It really took root even before that by the apostate anti-popes that supported scholasticism, but he doesn't make an account of it, as I mentioned before. In progress of the following work, we shall show that the Renaissance gradually took root in Rome under Martin V and Eugenius IV, that Albergati, Cesarini, and Capronica, the most distinguished among the wearers of the purple in the 15th century, so-called cardinals, encouraged humanism, that the sojourn of Eugenius IV in Florence and the general council held there produced marked effects in the same direction, until at last, in the person of Nicholas V, a man mounted the throne of St. Peter, who, full of confidence in the power of Christian Science, ventured to put himself at the head of the great intellectual movement. They say he was the greatest of all the humanists. And he was a humanist before he was an apostate anti-pope, one of the leading ones. His name was Thomas Petrin. We'll get his name down here later. This circumstance was the beginning of a new epoch in the history of the papacy, as well as in that of science and art, an epoch which reached its climax in the reigns of Julius II and Leo X. And that was from Volume 1, Introduction, pages 44 to 49 and 52 to 54. All right, now we're going to take a look at apostate antipope Innocent VII, whose reign as an apostate antipope was from 1404 to 1406. Again, we're reading from the history of popes. He, Innocent VII, summoned to the Roman University the most prominent professors of every science, not merely canon and civil law, but also medicine, philosophy, logic, and rhetoric, were to be studied in the school. Finally, says Innocent VII, that nothing may be wanting to our institution. There will be a professor who will give the most perfect instruction in the Greek language and literature. The terms of the bull and the enthusiastic praise of the Eternal City, which it concludes, reflects the increasing influence of the humanistic tendency in the Roman court. There is not on earth, it says, a more eminent and illustrious city than Rome, not one in which the studies we desire to restore have longer flourishes, for here was Latin and literature founded. Every kind of wisdom and learning took birth in Rome and was received in Rome from the Greeks. While other cities teach foreign sciences, Rome teaches only that which is her own. He's saying he's resurrecting the pagan Roman religions and false gods and philosophies. And he's proud of this, that he can be doing this. He's admitting that he's resurrecting paganism. And he's bragging about it. He ought to be ashamed of his past, of pagan Rome and the pagan Greeks. But he's not. But a few months after the publication of this bull, Innocent VII died, and accordingly everything was brought to a standstill. The times were certainly little favorable to the muses, and yet humanism continued to advance and make its way into the papal court. From the beginning of the 15th century, we find humanists in the papal service, no longer isolated individuals as during the Avignon period, but in great and ever-increasing numbers, and among them some whose appointment throws a melancholy light on the circumstances of the time. The most striking instance of this kind is the well-known Poggio, who became one of the apostolic secretaries during the pontificate of Boniface IX. Poggio held this very lucrative post under 8 different popes. I'm going to read to you about Poggio. And at the same time filled other offices. For half a century he was employed with sundry interruptions by his frivolous nature, was incapable of any real affection for the church or of any one of the popes whom he served. Okay, we're now going to read about the character of Poggio Bracciolini, who was, as we just read, served under 8 popes at the papal court. From History of Popes again. Poggio Bracciolini may be taken as a genuine representative of humanism. This gifted writer, the most famous fortunate discoverer the world has ever known in the field of literature. See how he praises these guys? maybe because he was eloquent or something, knew how to write good English or speak eloquently, is a man, one of the most repulsive one of the most repulsive figures of the period. Almost all the vices of the prolificate Renaissance are to be found combined in one person, and it would be hard to say whether his slanderous disposition or gross immorality of his life is most worthy of condemnation. Notwithstanding occasionally expressions of another kind in his writings, there could be no doubt that Poggio's point of view was more heathen than Christian. Christianity and the church were entirely outside of his sphere. And he's at the papal court. Eight so-called popes have him under him. To quote the words of the biographer of Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, he was such a worshiper of heathen antiquity that he would certainly have given away all the treasures of dogmatic theology for a new discourse of Cicero. Almost all the writings of Poggio are offensively obscene in course. And that's from Volume 1, Introduction, pages 29 to 30. When we go on again to read from the histories of Pope, he, Martin V, certainly says that they, the humanists, were necessary to him and employed many of them in his service, which Poggio entered in the year 1423. It is hard to understand how Martin V could admit a man of Poggio's character into his service, because he's an apostate anti-pope and he's an immoral bastard and an idolatrous bastard. That's why, you stupid. When it seems to be like when they become the pope, this guy gets them all off the hook. They become dumb when they become the pope. They're guilty when they're bishops. They're guilty when they're priests. They're guilty when they're laymen. They're even guilty some of the cardinals. But when they become pope, they're off the hook. It's hard to understand, isn't that? It's hard to understand. It's hard to understand how Martin V could admit its mystery of iniquity, right? Operation of error, allow the whole high. Look, if you read the Old Testament, how many times did God's religious leaders go bad? It is hard to understand how Martin V could admit a man of Poggio's character into his service. For the new papal secretary was what he had ever been. He himself tells us how, when the dull day's work at the chancery was over, he and his friends amused themselves by telling disedifying stories. They called their meeting place the Forge of Lies. And we may form a fair estimate of Poggio from the fact that at the age of 58, he published a selection of these anecdotes. The frivolous, absolutely heathen spirit of this Partisan of the Renaissance is but too plainly manifested in this work. With the exception of a few jests, which are harmless, it is entirely made up of coarse innuendos and scandalous and blasphemous stories. All ecclesiastical things and persons are turned into ridicule. Jokes and ribaldry of this description form the evening amusement of the men, whose pens were employed in the composition of papal bulls and briefs. Are these guys not infiltrators? They're not even like useful idiots. They're infiltrators that came into the church maybe so they can get gain and high office, but they're only pretending to be Catholic, and in their hearts they're not Catholic at all. They're absolutely direct infiltrators when you behave like this. And so are these apostate anti-popes for allowing it. How could a guy get away, these guys get away with what they did, unless they were supported by these apostate anti-popes who actually put them in the papal court, which then everybody's going to follow all these guys. You're giving these guys gap probation. And at nighttime, and it's not just nighttime they're doing this, they're writing books out in public about condemning the church, and the popes got them into papal court. It's unbelievable. It's almost like even these apostate anti-popes themselves, a lot of them were infiltrators. So now you know about the character of Poggio here. Now we go on with that quote in which I was quoting before. The humanists had raised themselves to the position of leaders of public opinion. They were well aware of it, and often assumed imperial airs. In the time of Innocent VII, Leonardo Bruni, whose name has been repeatedly mentioned in these pages, entered into the papal service. We're now going to read about the character of the humanist Leonardo Bruni, who was born in 1369 and died in 1444. He was also known as Aretino. And we're reading this from the Catholic Encyclopedia, Leonardo Bruni, and the article is written in 1908. An eminent Italian humanist of poor and humble parents in Arezzo, the birthplace of Petrarch, in 1369, died at Florence, 9 March 1444. He is also called Aretino from the city of his birth. Beginning at first the study of law, he later, under the patronage of Salutato and the influence of the Greek scholar Chrysoloras turned his attention to the study of the classics. In 1405, he obtained through his friend Poggio, so he belonged to the Poggio's gang, the post of apostolic secretary under Pope Innocent VII. He remained at Rome for several years, continuing as secretary under Popes Gregory XII and Alexander V. In 1410, he was elected Chancellor of the Republic of Florence, but resigned the office after a few months, returning to the papal court as secretary under John XXIII, whom he afterwards accompanied to the Council of Constance. In 1427, through the favor of the Medici, he was friends of the Medicis too, of course, he was again appointed state chancellor, a post which he held until his death. During these 17 years, he performed many valuable services to the state. Bruni contributed greatly to the revival of Greek and Latin learning in Italy in the 15th century. He, more than any other man, made the treasures of Hellenic work accessible to the Latin scholar through his literal translations into Latin of the works of the Greek authors. Among these may be mentioned his translations of Aristotle, Plato, Plutarch, Demosthenes, and Aeschines. These were considered models of pure Latinity. He was also the author of the biographies in Italian of Dante and Petrarch, and wrote in Latin on the lives of Cicero and Aristotle. So here's this guy, another bastard humanist at papal courts. Now we're going to go to read on from that article. From the first year of the pontificate of Innocent VII, whose example was afterwards followed by Eugenius IV, Nicholas V, and other popes, we find the well-known Pietro Paolo Vergerio, installed as the secretary in the Roman court. The marvelously rapid growth of the influence of this school in Rome appears in the fact that this humanist was appointed to deliver a discourse of the union of the church before the cardinals assembled in consistory previous to the election of Gregory XII, and that he was not afraid to say very hard things. Subsequently, it became more and more the custom to employ the humanists in the service of the popes, both in the chancery and in diplomatic situations, and the time was not distant when classical proficiency was the surest road to ecclesiastical preferment. If you weren't a humanist, you don't even get into the papal court. The place was overrun by them. Under Innocent VII's successor, Gregory XII, fresh humanists, amongst who was Antonio Locci of Vicenza, were won to the service of the papal court. And that's from History of Popes, Volume 1, Book 1, Chapter 2, pages 166 to 171. Now we're going to read about apostate anti-pope Martin V, whose reign was from 1417 to 1431. Again, we're reading from the History of Popes. On the 7th of September, 1418, it was determined to transfer the papal court to Mantua. On his way, Martin V tarried in Milan and consecrated the high altar of the cathedral. An inscription in the interior over the great portal and the medallion of the Pope in the gallery of the choir commemorate this circumstance. Beneath this monument is an inscription from the pen of the humanist Giuseppe Brippi in praise of the Pope. And that was from Volume 1, Book 2, Chapter 2, pages 211 and 212. We're going to go on with History of Popes on Martin V and Volume 1 also. I'll give you the exact source when I'm done reading it. The humanists who, during the time of the schism, made their way into the papal court formed a distinct and in many ways incongruous element in the body composed of ecclesiastics. In order to understand the position which the representatives of literary renaissance attained at his, Martin V's, court, we must remember that the Council of Constance had given an immense impulse to humanism. The Council of Constance, as the historian of humanism observes, inaugurates a new epoch in the history of the search throughout Europe for manuscripts. The dawn of humanism north of the Alps dates from this period. Among the papal secretaries present at the Council of Constance were many humanists. The most remarkable of them were the learned Greek Manuel Chrysoloras, Leonardo Bruni, who was but a short time at the council, and Poggio. Among the non-official humanists who came to Constance were, we may mention, the poet Benedetto da Piglio, Agapito Cenci, and the jurist Pier Paolo Vergerio, and Bartolomeo de Montepulciano. He, Martin V, certainly says that they, the humanists, were necessary to him and employed many of them in his service, which Poggio entered in the year 1423. When Valla produced his dialogue on pleasure in the circle, this is in Martin V's things, he knew his audience. These doings were carefully concealed from the Pope, whose name was by no means respected in their conversations. The reproach, however, remains that such men were his servants and were retained in his employment. Lorenzo Valla, another bastard humanist, real dangerous man, who even this humanist was, the devil used him to discredit the Donation of Constantine, which is absolutely authentic, and also to discredit the fact that the Apostles' Creed came from the Apostles. This man's the center one who passed those lies to discredit those genuine documents. We're now going to read about the character of Lorenzo Valla. He was born in 1405 and died in 1457. Again, from the History of Popes, Volume 1, Introduction, pages 13 and 16 to 19. No one had better expressed the program of the radical heathenizing party than Lorenzo Valla in his book On Pleasure, published in 1431. This individual, says Valla, plainly, may lawfully indulge in all his appetites. Adultery is in the natural order. It's not a sin. There you go. Glorifying immorality. He's saying adultery is part of the natural law, he said. Indeed, women ought to be in common. Plato's communion of women is in accordance with nature. Plato evidently taught that adultery is okay, too. This is Plato, the great pagan philosopher.
Liked it.
Yeah. Adultery and unchastity are to be eschewed only when danger attends them. Otherwise, all sensual pleasure is good. Pleasure, pleasure, and nothing but pleasure. Sensual pleasure is in Valla's eyes the highest good, and therefore he esteems those nations of heathen antiquity happy, who raised voluptuousness to the rank of worship. Sexual sensuality. He's praising them. Vice becomes virtue, and virtue becomes vice. Woe to you who call evil good and good evil, but darkness for light and life for darkness, Isaiah 5:20. This guy's at the papal court of a whole bunch of popes and Martin V. You can't. These guys are all pigs. They're all in on it.
Yes.
Vice becomes virtue, and virtue vice. All his indignation is called forth by the voluntary. All his indignation is called forth by the voluntary virginity, ever so highly esteemed in Christendom. He hates virginity. Continence is a crime against kind nature. Whoever invented consecrated virgins, he said, introduced into the state a horrible custom, which ought to be banished to the furthest ends of the earth. He's condemning virginity and chastity. This institution has nothing to do with religion. It is sheer superstition. Of all human things, none is more insufferable than virginity. You can imagine what a pig this guy was. And they were. They're all Sodom, all kinds of sodomites, all kinds of pigs. Observe, however, that all the divinities, with the sole exception of Minerva, were married. And that of Jupiter, so far as in Lahim, could not endure virgins. Oh, excuse me, so we're taking our lead. He's pretending that these divinities are true. He's talking about Minerva and Jupiter. This guy is at the papal court. Can you people, these guys are worse than the Vatican II Church. They're worse. They're all a bunch of criminals. This guy would be hogtied, tortured, and killed if I had power over him. I'd give him maybe a week to convert, maybe not even. If God inspired him, I'd kill him on the spot. These guys are inviting him to the papal court and they're writing papal briefs and they're all friends with them. No condemnations, no denunciations, and therefore no punishments. Of what I'm reading here is so gross. And these were made public. Everybody knew about what these guys. They passed these teachings around in their books. He said, observe, however, that all the divinities, with the sole exception of Minerva, were married, and that Jupiter, so far as in him lay, could not endure virgins. Those who profess themselves to be consecrated virgins are either mad or poor or avaricious. So, wait a second. First, he said, you believe Jupiter's for real? You know, you believe this guy's a real god? You don't believe it? First of all, even if Jupiter was some human being that they turned into a god, he was a perverted pig. He's glorying in the perversion. See, men make gods to fit their own lustful, sinful desires. And that's what mythology is. And he's extolling this. Valla was not alarmed by the attacks of theologians on his daring opinions, for King Alfonso of Naples was his firm protector. With equal audacity and venom, Valla turned his arms against the temporal power of the papacy. He's the Donation of Constantine was the one where Constantine gave to the Pope this power, this temporal, it told him, he gave him the palace and everything. So they're against the papal supremacy, they're against papal power in the papal states. Oh, and he's working in the papacy, under these guys. And as I told you before, Martin V and Eugene IV denied papal supremacy too. They held a conciliarist heresy and collegiality, I'm telling you that. These guys are all the same. Here, you're going to read it right here. With equal audacity and venom, Valla turned his arms against the temporal power of the papacy in his pamphlet on the falsely credited and invented donation of Constantine. That's what he did it. And since his time, they said, oh, the whole donation of Constantine is false. And also, the apostles never composed the Apostles' Creed. That came from him. Another lie. In Constantine's donation, if Constantine's donation be a forgery of latter times, he concluded, then the temporal principality of the Pope falls to ruin, and the Pope has nothing more urgent to do than to divest himself of his usurped power. In other words, the Pope has no right to any temporal power neither. So when the Church comes to temporal power in the state, the Pope has no temporal power, is what he's saying. It's purely a spiritual kingdom, but not even a temporal one. You hear that today. That's a big heresy of today. The virtues of Valla's denunciation, the virulence of Valla's denunciations against the overbearing, barbarous, tyrannical priestly domination has scarcely been surpassed in later times. That was from Volume 1, Introduction, pages 13 and 16 to 19. I think I said that in the beginning. So there's the character of this Valla, who was friends with many of these so-called popes and at the papal court. Birds of a feather flock together. As I said. I go on from that previous reading now. At the time of the reorganization of the court, and even before Poggio had entered his service, Martin V had nominated Antonio Locchi, secretary. The selection of this man, who was repeatedly sent on embassies, was disastrous, for he too belonged to the Renaissance. So who is Martin V? That's what he is, right? Mr. Adiventan de Scandola. Who try to come out and say you can be in religious communion with tolerati heretics. This is what he tried to say. Tolerati excommunicates. And other gross things he taught. The versatility of the humanists made their position at court more and more secure. They were of use on every occasion in the composition of bulls and briefs. They were writing the papal bulls, the so-called papal bulls and briefs. As well as in that of purely political documents, at the receptions of princes and ambassadors, and when appropriate discourses were required, either for festival or funeral, it was thought well to treat men who rendered such varied services with extreme consideration. They were everywhere. And that was from Volume 1, Book 2, Chapter 1, pages 256 to 259. And we're going on to read again from History of Popes. Among the cardinals appointed by Martin V, Giuliano Cesarini undoubtedly stands next to Capranica in regard to talent and capacity. An essential figure in the description of Cesarini will be wanting if we omitted all mention of his relation to humanism. Like Capranica, he was a warm friend of classical studies. To them, it has been said, he owed those graces of mind and speech which so enhanced his physical advantages. On his journeys as legate, he found time to search diligently for old manuscripts. This we learn from Cardinal Albergati, who shared his tastes. Niccolo Albergati, though less cultivated than Cesarini, held constant intercourse with the partisans of the new studies and did what he could to further them. Felfio, another humanist, Poggio, and Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, who later on became Pius II, and especially Tommaso Particelli. That is the future Nicholas V I was telling you about. Enjoyed his favor. And that was from Volume 1, Book 2, Chapter 1, pages 265 and 268. Again, we read from History of Popes. Martin V was buried in the Lateran, where his monument erected in the time of Eugenius IV is still to be seen, with his effigy in bronze and an inscription from the pen of the humanist Antonio Locchi, who describes him as the happiness of his age. That's what you put on your tomb, is a so-called pope, the happiness of his age? What kind of a monstrous thing are these guys? What are these people, folks? Temporum suarum felicitas. And that was from Volume 1, Book 2, Chapter 1, page 281. Now we're going to talk about apostate antipope Eugene IV, whose reign was from 1431 to 1447. Again, reading from the history of popes. Give an account of all the humanists who entered the papal service during the pontificate of Eugenius IV does not fall within the scope of the present work. We need only remark that their number was surprisingly great, and that notwithstanding the Pope's austerity, he had a few good things, right, as I said, and a whole bunch of other evil things, little or no regard was paid in their selection to Christian conduct or to religious sentiments. At this time, indeed, the antagonism which afterwards appeared was still latent, and the partisans of the Christian and heathen Renaissance associated freely with one another. The literary gatherings which took place every morning and evening at Florence, the Medici's home, in the vicinity of the papal residence with Manetti, Traversari, and Parentuccelli, included also Poggio and Carlo Marsuppini. Humanistic studies were warmly encouraged in this pontificate, as they had been in the preceding one, by Cardinals Giordano Orsini, Alberghetti, and Giuliano Cesarini, and Prospero Colonna, and Domenico Capranica. The last-named cardinal had a choice library of 2,000 volumes, which he generously opened to all students. Gerardo Landerini, another patron of the humanists, was raised to the purple by Eugenius IV at the Council of Florence. He had a valuable library of classical works, many of which were rare. His learning was justly esteemed, and the discourses which he made before the Council of Basel and an ambassador to the King of England were transcribed and regarded as elegant compositions. You see what these people are looking for? Elegance.
Yeah.
They were smart. They knew how to write very well. But our Lord condemns these subtle, eloquent bastards, right? Just because, in other words, they're extolling these virtues of these people. I'd rather have a guy who's crude like St. Paul, can't speak too well, but speaks the truth. But anyway, I don't like the way these guys speak. To me, it's barbaric. The subtle way they speak is effeminate and barbaric. It's not the way of the Bible. It's not the way God even speaks. They extol these people. I don't. I hate it. It's like having a sugary dessert that's overwhelmed with sugar. So sugary that you almost die from diabetes when from eating it, or sugar shock. It's so sugary and disgusting. But they like it. They love this stuff. They're talking about here. This cardinal was on friendly terms with Marsupio, Poggio, and even Beccadelli. And I can mention Beccadelli for you in a minute, his character. A circumstance which gave no offense to their contemporaries. It became more and more the custom to flatter the humanists on account of their literary services. Those were the days where the ascetic Albergati held constant intercourse with the half-heathen wits, and the pious Capranica welcomed Poggio's letters and addressed him as very dear comrade. Besides these cardinals, we must mention Bessarion as a diligent collector of books, a laborious author, and a friend of patrons of scholars. He was the protector of all the learned Greeks who had in any reason to apply to the papal court. It is not easy to pronounce a general judgment as to the circumstances which prepared the way for the pontificate of the first humanist who ever mounted the papal throne. Yet we may safely say that the contact of the Pope and the court with the vigorous literary life of Florence had in some respects an ill effect. It was undoubtedly one of the contributing causes of that predominance of humanists in the Roman court, which in itself, and still more on account of their heathen tendencies, awakened grave apprehensions. Grave apprehensions. You don't have to have no apprehension or doubt. It's right to the bullseye. This is pure heathenism, idolatry, immorality, formal heresy for glorifying immorality. What do you mean? I got to sit back and think about what's going on when these things are happening? And that was from Volume 1, Book 2, Chapter 2, pages 305 to 308. Again, from the History of Popes, we read, although it is a mistake to consider Eugenius IV as the first of the line of Renaissance popes, yet it is true that he prepared the way for it, and his actions in this respect is more apparent in the dominion of art and literature. He was a Renaissance man. He's the one that put the doors up in the Vatican. You see, he's lying. I say to you, that's why Pastor, they allowed him to write this stuff, because he covers people up and makes lies. And here's this guy lying. Eugenius IV was a full-blown humanist. He's trying to pretend he wasn't a human. He had him all over his papal court. He believed like they did. He was friends with the Medicis. And he's the one who put up the doors that desecrated St. Peter's with images that glorified false gods, false religions, and gross immorality and vice. This is the guy he's saying wasn't a humanist. He certainly was. So was Martin V, who came before him. And so were all the so-called popes before that, who even glorified, supported scholasticism. So he lies. After he tells you all this evidence about who Eugene IV has on his papal court, then he doesn't call him a humanist? You got to be out of your mind. No pope would allow somebody like that under him, and all these people under him, unless he shares in their sentiments. And he's sharing in the guilt of their sins by sins of omission. If he didn't agree with them, he's at least committing sins of omission for not condemning what they're teaching, not denouncing them, and punishing them, and being in religious communion with them. We're now going to take a look at apostate anti-pope Nicholas V, who reigned from 1447 to 1455, whose name was Tommaso Parentucelli. And he was a well-known humanist. They say he was one of the worst of them all. And we're going to read from the History of Popes, all right, Volume 1, Introduction, page 55. It has been said that the Renaissance itself ascended the papal throne with Nicholas V. That's another lie. It did not. It ascended long before that. So that's a big, big lie. All these other popes who he may not call humanists, who had humanists at their papal court, were humanists for even having them at their papal court. The founder of the Vatican Library, like Fra Angelico, whom he employed to paint his study in that palace, knew how to reconcile his admiration for the intellectual treasures of the past, treasures he calls them, with claims of the Christian religion. He could honor both Cicero and St. Augustine. Honor Cicero. There you go. He's glorifying this pagan philosopher. I told you, when you respect or honor pagans and their religious beliefs or pagan religions and false gods, that is glorifying them, and you're guilty of idolatry. He's honoring Cicero. And he could appreciate the grandeur and beauty of heathen antiquity without being thereby led to forget Christianity. Beauty. He's praising the classic, the antiquity, the false gods, and he's trying to merge it with Christianity. When you try to do that, you don't have Christianity at all. You don't have the Catholic God at all. You're a pure heathen, and you're even worse, you're a hypocrite on top of it. This is, though, pastor saying this, that he can mix these things, and he's trying to get him off the hook. Now we're going to read from the Catholic Encyclopedia on Nicholas V, and the article is written in 1911. Though a patron of art in all its branches, it was literature that obtained his highest favors. His lifelong love of books and his diligent and his delight in the company of scholars could now be gratified to the full. Nicholas welcomed the humanists to the Vatican as friends. He's not the only one, of course. His Catholic Encyclopedia is even worse than pastor. They hardly tell you anything. Carried away by his enthusiasm for the new learning, he overlooked any irregularities in their morals or opinions. It's because he held the same ones. He accepted the dedication of a work by Poggio, in which Eugene was assailed as a hypocrite. Valla and Voltaire of the Voltaire of the Renaissance was made the apostolic notary. In spite of the demands of his resources for building purposes, he was always generous to deserving scholars. If any of them modestly declined his bounty, he would say, "Do not refuse. You know you will not always have a Nicholas among you." In other words, go for it right now. Let's get as much corruption in here as we could. So when I die, I want it to continue on to my successors. He set up a vast establishment in the Vatican for translating the Greek classics so that it might become familiar with at least the matter of these masterpieces. And he had them recopied and spread out all over the place. He honored, loved them, and respected them and all that. Now we're going to take a look at apostate anti-pope Pius II, who reigned from 1458 to 1464. His name was Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, another famous humanist. And we'll read from the History of Popes, Volume 1, Book 2, Chapter 2, pages 340 to 341. Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini was secretary in the chancery of King Frederick III. He was among the noble figures of the Renaissance age. At an early age, he went to the University of Siena to study law, for which, however, he had but little taste. While the classical literature fascinated him, Cicero, Livy, and Virgil were his favorite authors. He scarcely allowed himself time for food or sleep, but pored day and night over these books, which he had borrowed from friends. See how they put all these our Lord said, the evil people are very zealous and they're evil. Like Michelangelo, a notorious idolater, immoral, apostate, heretic, they say he should stay up all the time painting and not even eat so he can get his evil work done. This is how much he loved these classics. They're not talking about the Word of God or the Scriptures. He loved these false teachings. It wasn't for historical purpose. He dived into them. After a time, he went to Florence to prosecute his studies and become the disciple of Felfio. And now we also read from the Histories of Popes, Volume 5, Introduction, page 30. Maffeo Veggio was a friend of Pius II. Now we're going to take a look at apostate anti-pope Sixtus IV, who reigned from 1471 to 1484. Again, we're reading from the History of Popes, Volume 4, Book 2, Chapter 1, pages 215 to 216. The bond between the new pope, Sixtus IV, and the Florentines was even closer. He looked upon the Medici as his natural allies. Friends of the Medici is the death seal. Those were the number one propagators, supporters of the Renaissance movement, all the evils of it. They were like the Rothschilds back then, definitely infiltrators. I have no doubt about it. Pretend Catholics whose job was to subvert everything. This was made very apparent when the Florentine embassy, headed by Lorenzo de' Medici, arrived in Rome to pay homage on behalf of the Republic. Its reception was most cordial and honorable. Two antique marble busts were presented to Lorenzo, and he was allowed to acquire gems and cameos from the collection of Paul II at a very moderate price. The financial affairs of the papacy were confided to the Roman Bank of the Medici, by which arrangement a rich source of wealth was opened to Lorenzo and to his uncle Giovanni Tornabuoni. Further concessions in regard to the loom works were granted to him. Emboldened by so many favors, the practically minded Medici at last took the courage to remark that he had but one desire unfulfilled, and that was to see a member of his family admitted to the Sacred College. To this request, Sixtus IV also lent a favorable ear, for he was unwilling to refuse Lorenzo anything. Now we're going to take a look at apostate anti-pope Alexander VI, the so-called Pope, the Borgia Pope, and he reigned from 1492 to 1503. Rodrigo Borgia was his name. And we're going to read again from the History of Popes, Volume 5, Book 2, Chapter 1, page 390 and 394. The coronation on August 26th was unusually splendid. Both the Florentine and Mantuan ambassadors agree in declaring that they had never witnessed a more brilliant ceremony. Innumerable multitudes flocked into Rome. Nearly the whole of the nobility of the patrimony was assembled. The streets were decorated with costly hangings, exquisite flowers, garlands, statues, and triumphal arches. All the grace and beauty of the Renaissance was displayed, but its darker side was not absent. The Roman epigraphists and poetasters, who some years later were remorselessly to load the name and memory of this pope with opprobrium, surpassed themselves in the ingenuity and rank paganism of their compliments. It would be impossible to exceed the profanity of some of their productions, of which the following distich is a specimen. Quote, Rome was great under Caesar, greater far under Alexander. The first was only mortal, but the latter a god. They called Alexander VI a god when they were proceeding. Now, we're going to stop there for 1 second. Does that remind you of any biblical verses of somebody who was called God and then God struck him dead right away because he was supposed to be a believer? Herod, the Jew. And later on, when they were giving him praises and they called him a god, God struck him dead for it. Let's read it. This is from the book of Acts 12, 21 to 23. And upon the day appointed, Herod being arrayed in kingly apparel, sat in the judgment seat and made an oration to them. And the people made acclamation, saying, It is the voice of a god! And not of a man. That's what they said to Alexander, right? And forthwith an angel of the Lord struck him because he had not given the honor to God, and being eat up by worms, he gave up the spirit. God killed him immediately. Why didn't he kill the Borgia, so-called Pope, immediately? And those people who called him a god because we're in the great apostasy. And for it to succeed, the mystery of iniquity, and for Antichrist to come to power, and for the faith to be corrupted and turned upside down, you need these guys to live. You need them to live and prosper one generation after another till we get to the point of bringing Antichrist to power. That's why God did not strike him dead. But God did punish him many times. Alexander VI and a lot of these other guys, he punished them severely. So he still was trying to convert them. All right? And they still weren't listening. But look what happened when they called Herod a god. Now they're calling him a god. Who else do we know in the Bible was called gods? And they said, men, we're not gods. Stop it. St. Paul and St. Barnabas, when they called them gods. And what did St. Paul and St. Barnabas do when they were called gods? Let's read about it. In the book of Acts, chapter 14, 10 to 14. And when the multitudes had seen what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices in the Lyconian tongue, saying, The gods are come down to us in the likeness of men. And they called Barnabas Jupiter, but Paul Mercury, because he was chief speaker. The priest also of Jupiter, that was before the city, bringing oxen and garlands before the gate, would have offered sacrifice with the people, which when the apostles Barnabas and Paul had heard, rending their clothes, they leaped out among the people, crying and saying, "Ye men, why do you do these things? We are also mortals, men like you, preaching to you to be converted from these vain things to the living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all things that are in them." He's saying, we're not gods. We're trying to tell you to stop calling men gods. Get away from this. Did Alexander the Sixth do this when they were calling him a god on his coronation? Did he behave like these apostles? And by him allowing that, accepting that, he's guilty of that, of idolatry, of putting himself up as a god. That one act alone is apostasy and idolatry, that they gave it and that he accepted it. Now you're reading here what a true Catholic behave and how God punishes it. All right? And what this Borgia guy was allowing them to call him a god. I repeat, and we'll go on with that quote. Rome was great under Caesar, greater far under Alexander. The first was only mortal, but the latter is a god. End quote. Ludovico il Moro had proposed that all the envoys of the Legate, Milan, Naples, Ferrara, and Florence, should present themselves in Rome together. According to the custom of the time, these delegates were chosen from the ranks of the most distinguished humanists and scholars. Thus, Florence was represented by Gentile Becci, and Milan by the celebrated Giasone del Maiano. The addresses delivered on this occasion were admired as masterpieces of humanistic eloquence, and extensively disseminated through the press, they were crammed with quotations from the classics. All from the mythological gods and everything, crammed. In public, this is taking place in his coronation. Okay, now that was from Histories of Popes, Volume 5, Book 2, Chapter 1, page 390 and 394. Now we're going to read from History of Popes again, Volume 5, Introduction, Section 2, page 143. The most objectionable of these was the attempt to introduce the heathenism of the elegant humanistic style into theological sciences. We find such an attempt in the Compendium of Dogma, published in 1503 by Paulus Cortesius, secretary to Alexander VI and later apostolical protonotary. Okay, now we're going to take a look at apostate anti-pope Leo X, who reigned from 1513 to 1521. He was a Medici. There were several Medicis that got into the so-called papal see, but they're really apostate anti-popes. And we read this we're reading from the History of Popes, Volume 5, Introduction, Section 2, page 142. The fact that he's a Medici says enough. And he was not just like going against his family. He was a supporter of everything the Medicis and humanism supported. Perhaps this infatuation is even stronger in another poet, Pietro Bembo. His epithets are purely heathen. In his hymn to St. Stephen, God the Father appears in his glory in the midst of Olympus. Christ is the holy heros. Mary is a radiant nymph. His letters are full of similar displays of bad taste, and he frequently expresses himself in the same manner, even when writing as private secretary to Leo X. He writes that way to Leo X. It's phenomenal. Yeah. Right? And I ended off with one more quote here. That was from History of Popes, Volume 5, Introduction, Section 2, page 142. And I'll end off with this quote here, History of Popes, Volume 1, Book 2, Chapter 1, page 272. The most zealous promoter of literature and art in Rome of the day under Martin V was the rich Cardinal Giordano Orsini. He had pictures of Sibyls painted on the walls of his reception room. He spared no trouble or cost in forming a valuable collection of manuscripts of the Greek and Latin classics, among other treasures which it included, 12 hitherto unknown comedies of Plautus and Moral Horrible Pig. The cardinal himself endeavored to restore the corrupt text of these comedies and intended to publish them, and some verses composed by Antonio Locchi. And that ends this section on humanism and humanist glory, favored or allowed by apostate anti-popes and others, also apostate anti-cardinals. This recording was produced by Mary's Little Remnant, 302 East Joffrey Street, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, 87901-2878, and can be accessed on my website at www.johnthebaptist.us.